This is Comic Shenanigans, episode 1022, A Conversation with Jim Zub. Welcome to the Comic Shenanigans Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Chapman. This is episode 1022. It's yet another conversation with friend of the show, Jim Zub. If you want to check out Jim's previous episodes of the podcast, you can check out episodes 368 back from April 2016, episode 794 from July 2020, and episode 986 from June 2022. I recently sat down with Jim just after Christmas. I guess this would have been the 27th of December 2023. Chat about really specifically his current work on Conan, which is just fantastic work through Heroic Signatures and Titan. It's such a phenomenal book. So hopefully, if you're checking out this interview, you're also a big fan of that particular book and all the work that Jim is currently doing on Conan. One thing I would actually mention as well that would be a good idea to listen to, because we do refer to it a fair bit in this podcast episode, is checking out an episode I recently did with Richard Starkings. He was recently on the show. He is an acclaimed letterer. We talked about his current work on the Conan book, and I kind of mentioned this on this episode, but I don't think I'd really thought about just how phenomenal an impact a letterer could truly have until I talked with Richard, because he was really expanding on kind of letter theory and what it meant and what his work meant in terms of how he was, you know, really came at it as an artistic expression, and what the art of lettering really was, which maybe sounds really, you know, a duh, but I did not feel that way. And I was like, wow, that's really, really fascinating. And I was really intrigued by how he approached it. So we talk about that here because he had talked again in the last 10 minutes specifically. He talked about working on Conan over De La Torre specifically. So we talk about that here. So if you want to check that out, that just came out back in October 2023 in episode 1011. So that was my conversation with Richard Starkings. Anyways, back to the man at hand. Jim is always an exceptional guest. He's always very gracious with his time. He's a true fan. He just loves comics, sword and sorcery, Conan. He loves all sorts of things, D&D. And you can always really feel that love and that passion come through in all of his work. And so I think you're really going to enjoy this interview. I really dug sitting down with Jim once again. So you can always email me at comicshenanigans@gmail.com. Rate the show on Apple Podcasts. Listen to us on Apple Podcasts or listen to us on Spotify. Once again, thank you so much for downloading and listening to the show. Upcoming episodes do include Al Milgram. I just sat down with him the other day. We have upcoming episodes scheduled, at least, with Glenn Greenberg, Mike Carlin, and others. So I'm really excited to be able to share those when it is time for those episodes to go live. So thanks for listening, and let's jump right into the episode with Jim Zub. Enjoy. Jim, welcome back to the Comic Shenanigans Podcast. How are you today?
Thank you for having me back. I'm doing good.
This is, it's interesting. This is your fourth time on the show, the first time since I've kind of brought it back after a year hiatus. It's interesting. I was looking back, and the last time we chatted, it was, I guess, the summer before, your Thunderbolts book with Sean came out. Right. And obviously before Murder World actually came out. I know you've been working on it a long time, but it was the first time it actually got published. And obviously, all the current stuff with Conan through Titan. So it's been a lot of stuff happened in the last year and a half.
Yeah, it's been pretty transformative. 2023 was good to me, and I'm really, really pumped for stuff coming up. It's been wild, honestly, when I think about it. A lot of really cool projects and a lot of fun stuff that's happened since last time we talked. I think that must have been middle of the year. 2022, we probably chatted.
Yeah, I think it was like June or something of 2022. What's interesting is I find for a lot of creatives like yourself, you're always thinking about the next project, right? You're always kind of working on the next thing, and then you come on these podcasts and stuff like this where we kind of force you to look backwards, and then you're like, oh crap, I did a lot.
Yeah, it can be weird. I do this thing at the end of the year where I'll do a summary of the year that was, and I'll post a gallery of stuff that came out. And that's also a pretty good way for me to get a feel for, oh, I did do a bunch of stuff, or, oh, yeah, right, that was this year. Because it can be weird, especially the stuff that comes out the early part of the year. You wrote it the year before. You know, you wrote it in the final months of the previous year. And so in your head, you're like, oh, that's a 2022 project. You know what I mean? But it's not. It's in production and coming out in 2023 or whatever. So it can kind of mess with your mind. And sometimes pitches you put in that you wait a long time for them to come about, or just, you know, especially I think post-pandemic, the scheduling on stuff is always different now. Yeah.
Very true. I'm going to take you way back for a second because I have a specific question in mind. But obviously, when you were working on the Avengers books back with Tom Brevoort, I'm curious. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Tom is now leaving the Avengers office after, like, what, 25 years or something?
Yeah.
Like, it's crazy. And he's going on to the X office. I'm curious if you have any specific memories of working with Tom while working on those Avengers books that you know, deem appropriate to share, or just a specific memory of working with him as an editor.
I mean, Tom's one of the best editors I've worked with. I don't know if I've specifically told you this anecdote. It's not Avengers specific, but it's honestly, I think, the first conversation I ever had with him after I had sent in the pitch for Thunderbolts. This must have been 2015, might have been late 2014. I'm not 100% sure. And Tom was fantastic. We got on a call and he basically said, you know, make this book your own. And one of the things he said very specifically that I remember is he goes, I can be convinced of things. And it was like, oh, okay, that's a very unique way of putting it. And essentially the concept was that if I had an idea and I was really passionate about it, he wanted that passion to show up in the stories. And if I explained something and it didn't hit the mark, that didn't mean no, that just meant maybe not right now, or go back and retool it so that he could understand why I was so enamored of an idea. You know what I mean? And that these things don't go away. You just, you find the right place for them or the right time for them, ideally. Mm-hmm. And so that's why he was always really good about it. He, you know, some of the editors I'd worked with in the past, they were very much kind of yes, no. They were in charge. And obviously they're the boss when you're working on a, you know, a commercial project. But Tom's trying to tap into specific qualities and your passion and your excitement. And there were times when, you know, he wouldn't necessarily – it wasn't something he was focused on, but he could see I was really like a dog with a bone and I wouldn't let something go, and I could eventually get it past him. You know, I remember when I had the on Champions, I wanted to take the kids to Weird World and do that thing where we turn them all into fantasy analogs of themselves. And that was very much me trying to do a bit of my take on, like, the X-Men and the New Mutants Go to Asgard kind of stuff. And obviously, you know, I'm well known in the sword and sorcery space, so that was sort of tapping into some of that excitement and trying to transfer some of that over to Champions. And Tom's not a Dungeons and Dragons guy, but our assistant editor, Alana Smith, she was just getting into D&D, and I was like, look, D&D's coming back into its own. And Tom was like, is it? And she goes, actually, it is, you know? And so it was kind of like her extra vote of confidence gave us the push to make that happen. And so Tom doesn't have an ego, but that kind of stuff. He's just like, let's find the best idea. Let's have fun with this, you know? But yeah, working on both No Surrender and No Road Home with Mark Waid and Al Ewing, and just a murderer's row of amazing artists. And oh man, it was so cool. The collaborative kind of process and the pressure that I felt to really kind of step up and make sure that I was contributing, and not that I don't normally, but like, when you're interfacing with two other really well-known writers and we're all trying to tell these cool stories, and the one-upmanship in the best kind of way possible, I think that was really fun. And Tom did a great job wrangling that and letting us kind of sprint when we could see where we were going with it. And he could kind of sense when we had it well in hand. I think one of the coolest feelings was doing No Surrender, getting our feet and figuring out how that process worked to collaborate with each other and jam on every single script. Like, we didn't do, I think it when DC did the 52, they had different writers doing each script, and they would, you know, all read each other's stuff, but essentially that would be one writer's complete issue. And we were writing on every single issue, scene by scene. We were sort of handing them off to different people and then having to Frankenstein monster all together. So you could never really tell if we did it right, who you could take a good guess, but it wasn't just a one-to-one, oh, this is a Jim issue or this is an Al issue or a Mark issue. And Tom just trusted that we were going to find our way through that. And once it worked out, you know, in some ways, I don't want to say it was easy because it wasn't, but by the time we came back for No Road Home, there was a feeling of, oh, we've got this down cold. And coming back to the Marvel office to do that second summit to plan out the second story, it felt, I don't know if the word victory lap, but it felt like, oh, yeah, let's do this again. We got this, you know, which was really cool. It was a really fun way of doing it.
Do you think, I mean, if you had been the one to kind of be doing, if you were in Tom's job at that point, would you have trusted people to do it, that the, as you said, kind of the Frankenstein monstering of a
it
of
was
an issue
weird,
like that?
Man. It was a weird choice. the way that came about, I don't know if it was necessarily something, we didn't talk about it in the office per se. What happened was we jammed that whole story. Every major beat of that story was built in one day at the Marvel offices. And then we had all of our notes and we came back and it was like we had, I think, 3 weeks for the first script. And then it was 2 weeks after that for each one. And a week got burned and no one did anything. I think we were all just sort of coming off of the meeting and waiting kind of for our marching orders. And Tom was really busy. He had a lot of stuff on his plate. And I finally emailed him because I was getting really itchy, kind of trigger finger. And I said, I don't want to be the first person to write a scene or whatever. But I feel like when I read through the outline and the beats for this first issue, I kind of have a sense of who might do what. Do you mind if I put together a suggestion, you know, list? And Tom said, sounds great, you know. And so I sent him a breakdown, everyone, all of us, a breakdown of that first issue. This feels like a 3-page scene and it ends on this is the page turn. And it was just this quick little point form note. This feels like an Al scene. And it was roughly 1/3, 1/3, 1/3. I don't think it was perfect, but it was close. And I sent it expecting to kind of, I don't know, someone to tear a strip off me or someone to tell me I didn't know what the hell I was doing, or I don't know. I was just nervous. Like, we got along well in the office, but here I am telling them what to do, like I'm the editor or whatever. And Tom just emailed back and said, looks good to me. And then Mark goes, let's get to work. And that was it. Like, everyone just went and wrote their scenes. And so in the 16 issues, we were getting done the first script, and I said to Tom, you know, who should break down the next issue? And he goes, do you mind doing it again? And I said, that's fine. And so out of the 16, I broke down 13 of them.
Oh, wow.
I think Al did the big Hulk issue, obviously.
Hmm.
I think Mark might have broken down the epilogue issue, and Al might have done another one where he was doing some heavy lifting on the Hulk stuff. But every other issue was me. And so I joked around. I said, if people like No Surrender, that's, you know, my fault. Like, the pacing is very much the way I would break an issue, you know, whether or not the individual panels or the dialogue or anything else, like beat for beat, pound for pound, scene for scene, almost every issue, there was minimal kind of pushback. I don't think if Al or Mark asked for one page extra here or there, I don't even remember, honestly. It seemed like it ran relatively smooth. And we kind of did a similar thing on No Road Home. I don't think it was as top heavy, but I still think I must have paced out over half of them on that one as well. So, yeah, it's crazy. It was a hell of a project. It was so much fun. You know, I've sort of joked with Tom, because, you know, we did them so that they would be released during Infinity War and then Endgame, you know, coming out. And I said to Tom, you know, that next Avengers movie comes out, we should get the band back together or whatever. And I guess that'll never happen now, which is kind of awkward. But yeah, it was so much fun. I love when people bring those issues or the books to me. And it's a real milestone in my career, and Tom's a big part of that. His faith in me to be a part of that kind of crazy project.
It does sound like it would really cement your confidence that, like, I know what I'm doing. The fact that, you know, you're de facto kind of putting it together for other people who are, as you said, like...
Not just that, Mark Waid.
Right? That's like, exactly.
That guy knows a couple things about comics. What the hell? Like, that was, I think, one of the funniest, weirdest parts was, you know, I met Mark and he was so great. I mean, Al's the most gracious and sharing guy around. But, you know, Mark's got so much more pedigree. And so I think I was a little more intimidated there. Mm. Al had started in the industry ahead of me, but we still felt relatively contemporary, if that makes sense.
It does.
But Mark's kind of a living legend in a lot of ways. And when he would give you the attaboy, you were just like, oh, damn, you know. But I felt that way about Tom as well. It was just a really cool collaborative kind of process in and around. I remember when we were doing No Road Home and I was writing, there was a huge battle issue. And I had originally sort of split it one-third, one-third. And then Mark kind of wrote back and goes, I don't mind doing more of the aftermath stuff. I'm sick of writing action and you're really good at it. And I was just like, oh, okay, cool. That was a, you know, compliment and very, very fun. And I do, I love writing action scenes. I love kind of choreographing them or figuring out how to make them interesting or visually dynamic for an artist if they don't already have an idea in mind. So yeah, it was just we really did kind of jam with each other so incredibly well, in ways that I think, and this is no offense to anyone else, I know the X-Men office did a weekly after us. Mm. And there was sort of talk of like, oh, Tom's cracked the code, he knows how to do this thing, and they just pulled all the X-Men writers together and said, do it sort of like this. And the X-Men writers were not kind of built to do that. And that's no offense to any of them. I think they were all skilled writers. They just didn't come in or just didn't jive the same way. The way they broke down a story or the way they thought about characters or plots or scenes, mm-hmm. It wasn't going to be that thing again. And so I think there may have been a month or two there where at Marvel they thought, oh, this will just be a thing. We'll get every major office to do a weekly book because look how successful that was. And then afterwards they went like, yeah, no, that was just Tom's thing, you know? So
it is interesting, though. I mean, I think Tom's been the one to say this numerous times that, you know, comics is this weird alchemy and you never really know what's going to work.
Yeah. Casting is such a huge part of it, right? Like, and the editors that understand that you can see where they would fit really well or their sensibilities and how you can plug people into it. A lot of times when I'm talking to new creators and, you know, they tell me the kind of stuff they want to be working on, and then I look at their own personal work or the other stuff they've been doing for other publishers, and it doesn't resemble that at all. Mm-hmm. And I get it in the sense of you got to take whatever you can get and you're paying the bills. But think of this like Hollywood, you know, actors. Like, if you're in a bunch of horror movies, they're probably going to cast you in more horror movies. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? If you do whatever, deep interpersonal kind of things, then that's what they're going to look to you to do. They're not going to do stunt casting. Like, this isn't. Mm-hmm. They don't look at you and go, I know you've never done this kind of thing before, but what the hey, kid? You know, like that's sort of not good. You have to sort of, you either have to be red hot and then you can say, I know you want me for this, but I'm going to totally pivot and surprise you. Or you have to, you know, re-demonstrate this is where I want to be, you know, and kind of surprise and build into it, you know. So that's part of the whole process. You know, now I'm known for all the sword and sorcery stuff and I've got such a huge backlist of those kinds of books. And so now if there's a dragon in it or someone's swinging a sword, I'm on your short list probably, like in some way, shape, or form. And that's cool. Like, I don't mind being typecast for my favorite thing. I can't really complain about that, you know? And so, but you've got to, I'd rather be known for something than not thought of at all. God forbid, right? So that's kind of a good kind of place to be with it as far as that goes. But yeah, at every juncture, one of the advantages of once you've got that backlist of material, people, superhero wise, they think of me for team books because I like doing the character dynamics and, mm-hmm. and sword and sorcery, they just think of me because I do a lot of it. So it's like, okay, sweet. And people like it and keep buying it and damn, get to keep doing it. It's amazing.
One thing I'm curious about, when you talk about, you know, obviously how you lay out pages, et cetera, I'm really curious because I remember a year or two ago, I spoke with Zeb Wells and we were talking about his process and he was trying to explain how he writes comics. And he was like, he was basically saying that he had never really been able to find creators who were open enough to talk about their process and that
really?
He had no idea if he was doing it right. And he was like,
I think it's working out for him. Okay.
And I think so too. And I've always been a huge fan of his work, but he was talking about how he uses like whiteboards basically to kind of lay out his pages so he can kind of start to visualize what the pages look like. So he can kind of understand, you know, what has to happen on this page, et cetera, sure. et cetera. And I'm curious like how you operate in that way. Like,
not on a whiteboard, I'm not actually drawing any of it out anymore, but I do have a page pacing breakdown because we're limited by the real estate, the page real mm-hmm. estate. How many pages do we have to do this thing? And sometimes you have more content than you need to jam in there and you need to make, you know, choices. And other times you can expand it out and go visually bombastic because you've got so much more room to breathe. Mm-hmm. And you can only see that when you have them in front of you. And so if it's whatever, I finished up the 2024 Free Comic Book Day issue for Conan. It's going to be 12 pages, but it's a very limited kind of story that's setting the table for a bunch of big things we're going to do and bringing new readers in. Okay, where's our big visual bombast and the unique real estate of a page turn that you know, an even numbered page heads into an odd one. And then the odd one can be a two-page spread, potentially. Where do you use that, and how effectively do you use that? For a lot of people, even if they're effective storytellers, but they're coming from another medium, that's the first thing that trips them up, is this idea of the page as a piece of real estate and the units of storytelling. Is this scene going to be most scenes are going to break at the end of a page. You know, it's rare you're going to break in the middle of a page or something like this. And so how do you use them and what is the most effective way to use them, you know, as far as that goes? And because I come from an art background, I'm thinking visually anyways, and it makes it a little bit easier. I know for some people who don't have as much of the artistic kind of end, I think they think of it more in terms of dialogue, or they're thinking of it very specifically like more like a movie script. And I'm always kind of coming at it visually, like this is comics first and foremost, you know?
So it brings up actually two questions with regards to your current Conan run, because first of all, you do have a little bit of expanded real estate because each issue is 22 pages. And obviously the big two don't do that anymore. So you have a little bit more space to work with than is typical. And also
I was surprised about that too. Actually, I'm pretty sure I wrote the first one 20 pages and then got told, you got two more pages. And I was like, what? Oh, man, I feel like I can just stretch out.
Right.
I just got an extra foot at the end of my bed or something.
Well, you have that, and also you have no ads. So you very consistently know exactly what your page turns are going to be, which
100%.
You don't always know in Big Two because there are ads that kind of do proliferate to a degree. So what is it like getting used to that extra real estate and knowing exactly where your page turns are going to be? It sounds like a small thing, but I would imagine it's quite a big thing.
It's
because
huge.
You can plan out very differently.
The new Conan runs even weirder than you know because Rob De La Torre and I came to, as part of bringing him on board the book, he and I had a discussion about it, and he really felt limited by full script as a process, that he didn't want to be told how many panels it takes to do a particular thing or when to do a close-up and when to blow it out. And that guy is a real, like, classic old school artist, not just in the style, but in his approach and his sensibilities. He is a complete unit in terms of real storyteller. And so I said I would be willing to do, you know, we're going to do it old school, Roy Thomas, John Buscema style. Let's do it all the way. I'll do what they used to call Marvel style, you know, where Stan would just write an overview. This is what happens broadly on the page. Maybe here's a very key piece of dialogue, or I may tell you, we absolutely need to have this visual component, but otherwise you can go buck. You know, we're doing an action scene. By the end of this action scene, these are the things that need to happen, but how we get there is up to you. And then I'll come back around and I'll add the dialogue or narration as required. And so working on the Conan book has been so different from any other series that I've ever worked on, let alone on a monthly basis, because of that process, where I'm not just imagining a scene in my head and hoping that I put down enough juicy, visceral information that the artist sees something in line with what I'm hoping for, but I'm giving Rob these big bombastic ideas, and then he blows it out visually, and then I get that line art right in front of me, and I think to myself, oh God, I have to live up to this, you know, tremendous page art, and summon every last ounce of narrative, you know, skill that I've got at my disposal to you kind of can't go too far with it. Like, when you read Robert E. Howard's, you know, Conan stories, they can be so big. The language that is used is so epic and intense and poetic. And at times it can almost feel like it slips into parody if you're not careful. Mm. And now I feel like I can't, I won't slip past the point, because look at it. It's just, the book's an absolute stunner, you know, and I'm just trying to sum it up as much poetry as I can and blitz it on the page. And when you hit that mark, it does feel, kind of getting back to what you're saying before, alchemical. It feels very special when you send back that, you know, lettering and script. And someone, Richard Starkings, absolute legend in the industry, is, you know, lettering up our book, and he's telling us how excited he is. I've told this anecdote a couple times, but it's quite relevant here. I'm at San Diego Comic-Con. We've got the pre-release copies of Conan number one there. I know, I've never met Richard in person, but mm-hmm. I know what he looks like, and he's doing such a phenomenal job on the Free Comic Day book and on issue one. And at that point, I think we were doing lettering on issue three already. And I walk past his booth on preview night at San Diego on the Wednesday night, and I finally got the print copies in my hand, and the book looks so stunning, and I'm walking on air, you know, at that show. And I want to just come over to his booth and thank him so much for all of his hard work and the effort he'd been putting in to get that old school kind of lettering on the title pages and the credits, and just everything looked so bang on. And I walk over to his booth, and he's got it, you know, he's holding court for a small group of people because he's Richard Starkings. And so I'm like, well, I'll swing by later because I don't want to bother him, and you know, I want to have a little moment to be able to introduce myself. And I start walking past, and he pushes past people in his booth, and he goes, oh Jim, you're not going to just walk by, are you? And I was just like, and I looked over at him. I was genuinely stunned, and I said, Richard, I didn't even think you knew what I looked like. And he goes, of course I do, I've been watching your interviews. And I was just like, what? Like, he'd been watching the Conan interviews I'd been doing in the lead up to the, you know, final order cutoff for the first issue. Mm-hmm. Because he's a dyed-in-the-wool Conan fan. You know, he said that was the book that kind of got him into comics, and it's such an honor for him to be working on the series. And he's lettered it, you know, at guys, 14, 15 years he was lettering it, you know, mm-hmm. previous. And to get him on the series, he hunted down Matt Murray, our editor, and basically said, I want to letter the new Conan, because he knew Rob Dillatore's art, you know, and he'd seen how amazing it was, and he was super excited to be involved. And so I was just sort of knocked off my feet. He was so excited. And I said, you know, I'm glad you're doing the book. I'm really proud of it. And he goes, you're really doing it, man. You're channeling the Robert E. Howard. It's coming out of your pores. And I was just like, yeah, I really feel it feels, you know, really special. And you know, Rob, and he goes, Rob's drawing like a goddamn demon. And I was like, I know. And we both start to get really excited. We're just in the aisle, just being these big kids. And we're so excited about our own book. It feels very, you know, egotistical, but it wasn't. It was very pure, like just the pure enthusiasm of collaboration and creation and working with people who are as passionate about something as you are. And Richard was just like, well, it's an honor to be on this team. And I'm thinking, man, it's an honor just to have you in the mix, you know. Mm-hmm. And he says, do you want to know the best part? And I'm like, what, Richard Starkings? What's the best part of lettering my comic book? And he leans in real close, like he's got a deep secret, and he goes, I get to read it before anyone else. And man, I was like, it absolutely blew my mind. Like, I was already riding high that night, and mm-hmm. you could have just sent me into the stratosphere. I was so so proud at that moment, you know, of what we were making and what we are making. Drop of a hat, Richard will jump on a Facebook video call with me now, and we'll talk about the most stupid little nuances of pushing a caption around or shifting something, because he cares deeply about the book and he wants it to read perfectly, you know? We were talking about, I think the first few pages that Doug did on issue 5, he was working on a different template, and stuff was nudging by literally millimeters. and Richard was like, oh, something's gone wrong, and wanted to fix it all and make sure that everything was just note perfect on the book, you know? And that is just because he wants it to be done right. And I am so grateful to be working with people like that who love what we're doing and see it all coming together on such a level. And the readers, you know, too, everyone's just like storming the gates on it. It is the coolest feeling I can possibly, you know, to have working in this business right now.
Mm-hmm. I do have to thank you, because in one of your newsletters you did shout out actually an episode of my podcast where I talked to Richard about, yeah, you know, his color and what he was thinking. And I will say that interview is probably one of my favorites, because I don't know how to say this without looking like a neophyte, but I don't know if I truly understood the true artistry of letters.
It's insanely huge. A lot of people in the business, they call it the invisible art form, because if it's working properly, you're too busy reading the damn story and getting swept up in it to realize how crucial the lettering was in that process. And when it's terrible, it's just like all the gears are grinding and you don't know why, because you're confused where you're looking and why and how this is supposed to sync up with the artwork. And when you find... Yeah. The same thing with logo design, the same thing with all that stuff. What is the dialogue font? How are the, you know, balloons being put together? What is the flow of the page? You can make or break that thing with really professional lettering. And I've seen samples from so many artists over the years and a lot of indie published stuff. And it's like, whether or not the artwork is of high caliber quality, if the lettering is good, you can get through it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And if the lettering is bad, it doesn't matter how damn good the artwork is. Like, you just grind to a halt on it. And that, it makes a huge, huge difference. And so when you have people who know what it's supposed to look like and why, and we're making these, we have the room to make these decisions, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And Heroic and Titan essentially just give us the steering wheel and just go, you guys know what you're doing. And we're like, yep, get out of the way. Here we go. You know, pedal down. Let's get as much momentum as possible on it. And so Richard and I will just jam directly. Like, I'll tell him, drop this, move that. You know, oh, that caption doesn't work as well as I thought it would over there. How do we solve this? Is this necessary? And how do we make it work? And those are fun little bits. It's the most ludicrous things that I don't think 90% of our readers would notice or care about. But we've gone through it with a fine-tooth comb, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting talking to him, and we were talking about how specifically in the first four issues, and this is obviously something he did over Rob, where at times he would just drop, there wouldn't actually be a narrative box. They would just have the lettering directly on the art. And he was saying how it was going to be different with Doug. But at the time, I hadn't seen Doug's stuff yet.
So I'm doing full script for Doug. So I'm literally doing both kind of styles of writing. So for Rob, I'm doing these outline style. Rob does the art. And then I'll do a lettering script specifically. I sometimes do a lettering position breakdown. Like, Richard, this is my first pass where I think the lettering should go, but you're the expert. You know, make judicious choices as required. But this is what it looked like to me, agree or disagree kind of thing. And then he'll send back the lettering proof. And it's like probably 90-95% of the lettering positions the same, but then he's the best, so he knows where it's gonna, you know, work even better. And then when we get the final colors in, every so often there might be a nudge that's required because of what we call line tangents. You don't want the edge of a caption or colors to pop weirdly or you know, stuff like that. So then you're just making hopefully almost zero changes, but every so often a little subtle one just to eke out a little bit of extra clarity on it.
Now, I can't recall if you did this when you were doing your Marvel Conan stuff, but were you Grim Jibs up there? Or
I was not. No. I was not. That was a bit of a surprise. So Matt Murray, our editor, he did those credits on the Free Comic Day issue without telling me, and I didn't see that until we got the final proof for the issue. He had done that as just like his own kind of fun throwback. That wasn't a suggestion from me. That was just he knew we were trying to summon that Bronze Age feel to the book, mm-hmm. and he felt like it was appropriate. And it is crazy now because, you know, the irony was that I'm called Grim Jim's up because I'm the least grim kind of guy around. You know, you meet me at a convention or anywhere else, I'm very talkative and very upbeat and what may have you. But that branding is starting to stick. I'm getting a lot of people when they're asking for interviews or whatever, they're calling me Grim Jim or the Conan branding could not be stronger right now. And it's crazy. Currently, I'm the only writer who's written Conan at kind of all three major publishers, right? I wrote some Dark Horse miniseries stuff with Gale.
That's right.
Obviously a run at Marvel and now at Titan. And there's going to be more people as the new Savage Sword launches in February and what may have you. But I'm on Conan for the foreseeable future, and I've got a lot of room to build out the mythology and do big, crazy things, kind of blasting on as full blast as far as I can go, because I never even thought I'd get this chance again. So better make the most of it. I don't know. Everything Conan related now, people are sending me. Like, I get tweets and messages and texts and anything, any sort of rumors about movie stuff or video games or the new expansion for the board game or biographies of Robert E. Howard or other stories he's written or fan art. Like, I am tagged into all that stuff now in a way that I've never been before, which is really heartwarming and kind of throws you for a loop. You realize like you are deeply now hitched to this character in a really cool way, in ways that I'm sure tons of other writers have been, you know, but whatever, Donny Cates on Venom or, you know, mm-hmm. Al Ewing on Hulk or, you know, stuff like that. If I'm using some modern examples, it feels like I've got that kind of attachment now in people's minds that I'm the Conan guy, which is a crazy prospect, especially if you think about where I was two and a half years ago, you know, kind of carrying out the book as it was wrapping up at Marvel and just sort of being like, well, that was the thing that happened, you know. So yeah.
Now, one thing that Richard had said when I spoke to him is that he kind of described your work with Titan on Conan as kind of you being unfettered and kind of more unadulterated, you know, Jim, in terms of what you wanted to do with Conan. Does it feel different? Or like, and that might be a very naive thing to say, but like, does it?
I don't want people to get the wrong idea. I got to do the stories that I pitched to Marvel. Do you know what I mean? Like, I pitched pretty straight down the middle sword and sorcery action storytelling at Marvel, and wanted to get this monthly rhythm kind of going for the book. And because of that, for better or for worse, I was trying to channel pretty classic Conan stuff, but they also weren't, there was nothing sort of world shattering about them. And I'm really proud of those stories. I think they're really good. The difficult part is that we slammed into stuff that we never could have. You know, first of all, we were coming off of Jason's 12 issues. Mm-hmm. And Jason had told this 12-issue epic. And then we sort of were settling into this like, yeah, Conan stories, 3 issues, 2 issues, 4 issues, whatever. Mm-hmm. But it didn't feel like required reading. Do you know what I mean? Well, what I thought would be a strength was that you could drop in anytime because it's Conan. Everyone knows Conan. Mm-hmm. And that was true, but we also slammed right into a pandemic and Conan was certainly not a priority for readers in that sense. It didn't feel like if you missed a month or, you know, the cliffhangers weren't so ludicrously compelling that, oh my God, they can't do that. What are we going to do next kind of thing? Mm-hmm. And I was sort of trying to pace myself like, this is going to be a marathon. Like, I gotta, you know, eke out these really cool, longer term stories and build up steam. And it's like the modern comic publishing business is not about, they just don't give you that room. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so that was, even for all the work I've done, that was very naive of me, you know, that I didn't try and swing out an epic right from the start. I kind of did like a line drive and I was like, yeah, Conan's in a dungeon and he's getting in trouble. And it's totally cool. I like the End of the Crucible story a lot.
Hmm.
And Marvel, you know, hey, Jim does fancy stuff and this is a good fit and let's go. The pandemic kind of knocked our legs out from under us and stole a lot of momentum. But if I have to be critical of my own stuff, I also didn't make it like, if you're not reading Conan, you better sit up and take notice. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's on me. You know, I told the stories I wanted to tell and I told them competently, but this was not the time. I don't know if there's ever a good time to sort of rest on your laurels. And I wasn't resting, but I also wasn't. I wasn't thinking of it like a marketing opportunity. Like, okay, Jason Aaron, one of the top rated writers in the industry, is leaving this book. Why are you sticking around? Ah, because it's going to be good. You're like, oh, good comics are good. Let's read it. You're like, yeah, maybe. Don't take that for granted. Like, just come in like a bat out of hell and go for broke. But it was weird because it was like, in some ways, because I was such a big fan of Conan, I think I was worried about breaking it, or I was worried about, you know, tipping it too far. So it's like, I'm going to prove to you I can do nice, solid, right on the nose kind of Conan. And it's like, cool. And I did. But then the industry and the pandemic and everything else, there was just, it just wasn't going to happen. Like, almost right from the get-go, we got swallowed up. You know, we had a 7-month gap between part two and part three of my first story.
Mm.
And that stole a bunch of our sales momentum. But even then, the reviews we were getting on the book were like, this is good Conan. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But it was like, if you weren't already a fan, there is no reason for you to jump in. Like, it is just, it's waiting for you at some future juncture. Maybe you should buy the trade. Maybe. And that was kind of true. Like, when I look back and I think about it, I'm like, yep, you know, if this was the 80s and Conan was just like a rock solid book with a killer subscription base, I would not have embarrassed myself. Do you know what I mean?
Hmm.
But it wouldn't have been like, oh my God, you know what my favorite Conan story was? Jim's, you know, like that wasn't the kind of stuff that I was making. And that's on me. And so when it slipped from my grasp, I was so angry at myself and so frustrated that I hadn't done the big things that I had thought about, that I hadn't gone mythic in a way that I should have. So then just having the discussion with Fred Malmberg at Heroic Signatures, and then they were talking about that they were looking at going it alone and they were going to self-publish. They were going to find a publisher, but they were going to create their own imprint, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, you know, we'd love to hear. We know you had bigger ideas, you know, at some point. Do you want to throw some stuff at us? And in some ways, I could be fearless because it wasn't going to happen. Do you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. There's no way they're going to hire the same guy to do the run again, like to do another run on Conan after he just finished up a run that it wasn't a failure, but it certainly wasn't like one for the ages. Do you know what I mean?
It's interesting because I get what you're saying, but it's interesting to me because I was someone who never really grew up on Conan, didn't know much about Conan at all. I read Jason Aaron's version, and then I actually gravitated more towards yours, and I really liked...
And a bunch of readers did, absolutely, because and I appreciate that, because I felt like we were doing classic sword and sorcery stuff. I don't think we did a bad job or anything. I'm not trying to like trash on my book. What's been really fascinating now has been hearing that people have been picking up those Marvel trades and really enjoying them, because it's like I kind of proved my stripes on the new Titan stuff, and they're mm-hmm. now more open to it, if that makes sense. You know, they just want more. But yeah, pitching Fred and basically going like, well, this will never happen, so I can kind of be fearless and just go crazy, like go nuclear and go, this is how big we can go. And this is what, if you're starting kind of fresh, here's what you keep and here's what you need to discard. And here's what I think could feed a potentially a lapsed readership that was super passionate about this stuff and hasn't been for a very long time, you know? And you've got the benefit of a mature reader's title. And that's, I think when Richard's talking about me being unfettered and unleashed, that's just a byproduct of that as well. We can be so much more violent and so much more sexual and so much more pulpy than we would ever have been able to get away with at Marvel. And it's not that Marvel was sending me reams of notes and trying to cut us off. I didn't even try to do a bunch of the stuff that I'm doing here because I know where those guardrails are. Do you know what I mean? Every so often we would bump up against something, but I got more notes on Murder World than I ever got on Conan. You know what I mean? Because in some ways we were trying to blur the line and do, Ray and I were trying to do stuff that you can't do at Marvel. At Conan, I think I got a couple notes. We got notes about, we would always, every time there was limbs being lopped off or sexual content, we would have to have discussion, like how far we can go or where, how Raj or Corey or someone is going to stage it. But that was really, it's how do we solve this? Not let's not do it. You know what I mean? Whereas at Titan, it's just sort of like, how far do you want to go? Like, how far does Rob want to go? How far does Doug want to go? And you'll see a big difference between 5 and 6. Doug in issue 5 is sort of finding his legs, not artistically. It's brilliant. But in terms of the R rating of it, the mature reader's rating of it, the first issue he draws is, it's not, it's still violent and it's still sexy, but it's like not as bonkers as once he hits issue 6 and we're like, yeah, you know, Belit can be naked and, you know, these characters can be eviscerated as far as you want to go. Like, this is like sword and sorcery by way of a horror movie. You can just push it and push it. And Doug's not used to being able to do that on a book. And so once he got that head of steam and he started doing it, it was like, oh, damn, we have unlocked something pretty awesome here. And I was showing, you know, Rob some of those pages and Rob goes, we can do that. And I was like, yep, and look out, you know, like arc 3 is going to be even more crazy in that way, which is kind of fun.
As I flip through, you know, Rob's first arc, it's interesting knowing now what you've said about how you kind of wrote it Marvel style and kind of had to kind of go in afterwards and kind of do some of the scripting and the narrative boxes, et cetera. It almost, I can start to see that more in a way that I do like, because you can tell where if you had been writing it full script, you would have had probably more, well, maybe you would have had, maybe you wouldn't have, but there's a lot of like the sequences of, now I'm forgetting her name, but Conan and the
Brissa,
as they go through in their adventure, there's a lot of sequences that are very silent. They're not really talking to each other. You're communicating to the reader what's happening in the kind of broad strokes, but they're not talking to each other, which actually works better.
There's a lot of narration. I mean, it's the most narration I've ever written on any comic, even more than I wrote on the Marvel Conan run. And that was also a byproduct of not only me, like Rob's drawing this, you know, pulp Bronze Age kind of throwback. And so I looked back again with a much more discerning eye, like how much Roy Thomas would use narration and how he would fill in the gaps in terms of atmosphere and sensory information that the reader couldn't get just from the visuals, you know? And then I also reread, I'm actively rereading Robert E. Howard stuff constantly now, and the poetry and the use of language is so beautiful and so powerful, and I've just wanted even more of that. And I feel like I did that every so often. There's pages in the Savage Sword story I did, The Gambler, that I think we hit a really cool kind of literary-ish kind of feel and a pulp feel. There's moments in Into the Crucible and, you know, Land of the Lotus that I feel it, but it's like slipping through my hand like sand. Like I'm trying to grab it, and it's like issue 2 of Conan, the new one at Titan. It's like almost every page I was getting that kind of rush, like I felt it. And issue 3 just as much, you know, that rush of like, oh, we are in the pulps and we're summoning this character from decades past and we're bringing it to the page with as much force as humanly possible, you know. I would read some of the original issues of the Marvel run and the fans would be writing, you know, to Roy Thomas and saying how much they love the comic, and they knew there were certain things they could never get away with, you know, within the Comics Code authority. But considering that this was, you know, a beautiful representation of this character that they've been a fan of for decades. And I feel like we've got the best of all worlds. We can take the visual cues that people think of as intrinsically Conan from the comics, but we can also now push it to that place that the pulps really went or hinted at and make it the forbidden fruit that I'm not saying we're better than. I'm just saying that we can sort of we're standing on the shoulders of those giants and we can push it even further now, which is very, very cool. That savage sort of Conan would occasionally have a breast or would have some violence that would shock you as a 8 or 10 year old. And now I can shock a 50-year-old fan of Conan and be like, holy crap, like they can, you know, that we can summon that same kind of electricity in them with the current book, you know.
It's interesting. I mean, as you said before, you know, trying to recapture some of that sense of magic and obviously of pure, like, you know, Roy Thomas was a fan of this stuff. He was channeling something he loved, right? And then you have, you know, Richard is obviously channeling Sam Rosen, who, you know, brought this letter palette, and he's trying to, like, represent that. And even as you said, with, like, the colors he's choosing, like, how it was difficult to choose the right yellow, and he had, like, a yellow with red in it, like, just so it would kind of evoke that old style. It's interesting how you guys have tried to synthesize elements of this, you know, that classic Conan that kind of brought it to the comic book masses, but also make it much more modern. As you said, kind of freed from the, you know, the constraints of the Comics Code authority and being able to do things that they wish they could have done.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is it is a loving homage, but we're not just retelling the same stories. Like, you know, one of the things in my pitch was that we had to avoid doing straight adaptations of the canon Conan stories, not because they're great, but because they've been done multiple times very, very well, you know? Like, I'm not going to be able to out Buscema, we're not on Tower of the Elephant, you know, without Callahan Inks and the classic Savage Sword run. We're not going to be able to outdo, you know, Kerry Nord on you know, Tower of the Elephant, or like these... Or Rogues in the House or any of that kind of stuff. It's like, those are amazing adaptations. And we want to be able to take some of that material from those canon stories and use those to fuel other things happening in the Hyborian Age. But I don't want to be a cover band, you know? We don't just want to play the hits over and over and over again. We've got to try and make new music using the same kind of instruments, if that makes sense.
It does. One thing I thought was really interesting reading the, you know, the issues with Rob and then reading the ones with Doug, I mean, obviously Conan still sounds like Conan, but at the same time there is a different feel to, and I would imagine this comes across for you because, you know, you're, as you said, you're writing a script for Doug, so it is different.
Yes.
And then when you see what Rob gives you, it is different because you have a very specific visual that you're actually pairing that dialogue with now. So how does that feel different to you? Because it's still Conan, but it is Conan by Rob.
I mean,
Conan
it helps by Doug. That Rob did the first 4, so I was able to build up that head of steam in terms of the language and that my confidence in being able to summon that kind of narrative feel. And the fear of, oh God, we're launching this book, I can't fail. Like, I've been given this incredible opportunity with one of my favorite things. Again, how do you, you know, if you screw this up, like, just hang your head in shame for all time, right?
Well, that's what I was going to say. Is it almost harder the second time?
It was easier to pitch because, like I said, it shouldn't happen.
True.
And then once I was given the reins and they were like, who do you want to draw it? And I said, Rob's my number one choice, because that's going to bring the old school fan base back. And I think is counter programming to a lot of what we're seeing right now on the stands. Not that any of that stuff's bad. There's a lot of books I love, but we need to stand out as something different. You know, we need to stand out from the Marvel run. We need to stand out from other current comics and go, this thing is a visceral thrill ride that your grandpa's going to like, and your dad's going to like, and you're going to like, you know, like, and so, yeah, whereas when I talked to Doug and we got him on board, he had never drawn Conan before and he was open and eager to give it a shot. And then I said, you know, I don't know how well you know the stories. And he's like, he's read some of them and he knows it more in the comic book sense. And I was talking about how I worked with Rob and he said, honestly, I don't mind getting the direction and I can make choices. I can combine panels or I can, you know, explode them out where I feel it's necessary, but I want to know what you think the choreography is rather than you just letting me run wild, you know? And I said, cool, that works for me. Obviously that's the way I normally write, so that was no problem. And so I was able to kind of, yeah, it is this kind of fun thing where we're swapping back and forth between those styles. And because both teams are working simultaneously, like, you know, right now, Doug is just wrapped up on, you know, issue 8. But, you know, De La Torre's 3 issues into the next arc already. We've been making those issues simultaneously.
Wow.
And next week, Doug's going to start drawing issue 13, you know? So it's like this, it's a constant flow of production between the two teams. And I'm working on both pretty simultaneously. Sometimes I'm doing full script. Sometimes I'm doing plot style. Plus I'm doing Savage Sword content and we're doing an event next year. And I'm writing a prose story for the first issue of Savage Sword. So depending on how you measure it, I'm working on 4 or 5 Conan stories at the same time.
How do you balance that in your head then?
I don't know. I love it. It's all just kind of there. It's all stuff I've been wanting to do for ages. You know, and so it, for me, it just feels like it's just pouring out of me. Like it's just, oh my God, people are reading and they enjoy it. Well, check this out. We'll check this out. Like, let's go here. Let's blow this out. Let's go crazy. And I get on a call with Matt or Chris Butera or whoever else from Heroic and we're jamming ideas and I'm exuberant and excited. And at this point, kind of waiting for them to tell me no rather than not throwing those ideas out there. I'm much more visceral and forward about what I think because I want to make the most of this momentum that we've summoned up right now, you know? And so I don't know, it feels weird because it's like these stories are sometimes the different eras of Conan's life. So you sort of dial yourself into that headspace. You're like, oh, this is young Conan. Okay. He's impetuous and he thinks he knows everything. And, this is older, more grizzled Conan. He's been around a lot. And, you know, you sort of get yourself into that headspace. It's all, for me, it's all role playing. It all comes back to Dungeons and Dragons and getting into character and stuff. So, and when you've got the artwork in front of you, that becomes the fuel. You know, with someone like Rob or with Doug, you're like, okay, I'm going to get you in the headspace that I feel right now. Like, I know how far we need to go. Let's just go crazy. We were talking about a sequence in issue 7, and I was essentially like, you know, a lot of the stuff that De La Torre did was these big mass combat scenes. They look like, my God, you know, like Renaissance paintings of death. There's just like figures flying everywhere in the most Frazetta-esque kind of style. And I said to Doug, you know, we need to switch gears. I want to have like some one-on-one kind of duels. Like let's Conan versus one really badass, you know, opponent. And how can we choreograph this to make it feel beautiful and visceral and feel just as dangerous, but not because there's an army rushing us, but just because there's one really scary person. And he really, you know, he got the assignment. Of course he did. He's a consummate professional. And so he just pushed it, and we were thinking about how to use the environment and how to use the space and how to make this feel as visceral and nasty as possible. And I kept sort of referencing almost like horror movie kind of trope elements where we were like, this is a relentless foe that will not, you know, quit, that's just chasing us down, and how can we make this base feel too small and make it feel like this thing is pressing down on him as much as possible. And Doug got it, man. He really, really got it, which is so cool. And then my one wish, once we started to see work from Doug, I was like, man, I hope we can get him back for ARC 4. And he really we got on a call with him, and I thought he was getting on the call to tell us that he wasn't going to do it, that he was going to let us down easy. And he really kind of held his cards to his chest in a very dramatic fashion. And he said, you know, I've been thinking seriously about your offer to stay on Conan for another arc. And we were like, yep. And he goes, there's nothing I'd rather do. And I'm just like, oh my God, you know, what a cool compliment. Sort of this big exhale. And we were like, all right, let's really, now we've got this open field. We know we've got the art teams, and they're both roaring, and we're super excited. So let's just keep it going, you know?
So that brings up a question too, and maybe this goes back to the fragmented nature of what it was like at having Conan at Marvel. It sounds like there's been much more of a clear remit and kind of a commitment to you in terms of how long this thing is going to go.
And that's, again, nothing for love, my crew at Marvel. Mark Basso was a great editor. Everyone on the team worked their ass off. I never want people to get the wrong idea that I have some axe to grind with my friends at Marvel or any of the people I worked with. Everyone went into the assignment with the best of intentions. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. No one knew a global pandemic was coming. No one knew. I wanted to be on that book long term. And in my head, I was like, I thought that I had to stretch that thing out. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And the visceral competitive nature of comic book publishing in the 2020s, there is no room for the bad side is you don't get quiet issues anymore. Mm-hmm. People don't feel like they're getting their money's worth, and you kind of have to earn them. You have to earn, like, our first quiet issue of Conan, if you can even call it that, it's still going to be action aplenty. But if you want to say like a exhale kind of step back, is literally issue 13. So it's like we've given you a year of absolute balls to the wall, you know, pedal down, crazy. All right, did we earn your trust? Can we slow it down just a touch to exhale and get you ready for the next big epic? You know what I mean? And I didn't fully appreciate that. And so it does feel different in the sense that when Fred and the team at Heroic made, they decide they wanted to go forward with my proposal. My proposal was sort of very classic in the sense of, here's the big picture idea, but we can segment it, or, you know, if it goes poorly, we can cut it off here or whatever, because you need to give yourself an out. And Fred essentially is talking to me, and we're negotiating this thing out, and he goes, well, here's the thing, Jim, you know, we need a long-term creative partner. And he's telling this to me like it's some negative, you know, because some writers don't want to be pinned down, right?
True.
Because generally speaking, you're going to get the most excitement off of the number one and the launch. And then you've got that credit under your belt. And then if you move on to something else, you get a new wave of excitement, right? Mm-hmm. Like even when a book is lauded, you know, whatever, the third year of Immortal Hulk is never going to have the same viscera as year one in terms of press coverage. And the best you can hope for are articles that say, are you still reading, you know, like that? Some people don't want to get pinned down, or they're just, the market doesn't seem to respond well to that, you know? And so they basically said, look, Conan is a worldwide property. The book sells in multiple languages, and the foreign market doesn't want a new creative team every, you know, 5 months. Mm-hmm. They don't want to wonder whether or not this thing's going to continue to be published from month to month or year to year. They just want really good, solid storytelling. We would like to make a long-term, you know, longer-term commitment. Can we start with 2 years, 24 issues? And I was just like, oh, thank God, because that's the kind of, you know, run that I want to do. That's the kind of stuff that I want to do. And for me, if it was just about the credit, man, I've already got Conan credits. Mm-hmm. You know, that is a little thing you can put in brackets after my name and it's done. But that's not why I'm here. I want to tell big, cool stories and feel this, you know, burning need to make a mark on this thing. And so that was really kind of the perfect proposal right from the start was, hey, we're going to give you the track. Mm-hmm. You're going to have 24 issues to really go. And
which is unheard of.
It sounds weird. It shouldn't be. I mean, it shouldn't be, you know.
No, but what makes me in this day and age. Yeah,
I know. In this day and age, that's the kicker, right? I think one of the big mistakes that these publishers are making. I mean, I made fun of this when I was doing Skull Kickers, and we did 5 months of new number ones as a joke about how often that reset button was being hit, right? And now it feels like it's true. Like, and this is no offense to anyone working on any of these books or any of these publishers trying to navigate this market. It's just like, man, a 12-issue run feels like celebratory. Like, my God, this is craziness, you mm-hmm. know? Mm-hmm. 3-issue miniseries and 5-issue canceled ongoings. And, like, how do you find your feet? How do you even get up to speed? I think that's the there's no other word I can say, the blessing of coming back to Conan is I figured out how to write Conan, and then they gave me the chance to do it even better. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that just doesn't happen. No one goes, yeah, you did good, solid line drives. We bet you you're going to hit a home run next time. Like, you had your shot, kid. Move on. Like, that's the typical approach to these things. The feeling of, you know, whether it's in prose publishing or in comics, the idea of whatever you want to call a mid-list author doesn't really exist anymore. It's like, are you a hit maker? No, get out of the way. Maybe the new guy can hit a home run right on his first try, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is a disservice to the craft. It's a disservice to the kind of ongoing experimentation and storytelling that actually makes whatever these shared superhero universes or mm-hmm. fictional spaces so special is you need to give people the space to, you need to give them the mentorship, you know, editorially. Mm-hmm. You need to be able to, and the same true with the artists. You need to give them space to grow as artists. And it's amazing when you see an artist come into their own, when they bloom on a book. But you have to recognize that skill and then be able to cultivate it. And it feels like everyone's so scared and the numbers are so volatile. We ain't got time for that. And so everything just goes through the threshing machine instantaneously.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I feel like that happens in TV too, right? Like, we used to have 24 episodes a year. Yep, so you'd have a few that were kind of slower and maybe not as good, but you had a lot more content. And now you have like 5, 10.
But you also had an audience that was more willing to be patient. So it's both, right?
Yeah.
It's not the publisher's fault. They're responding to an audience that is willing to drop, you know, a book instantly, right? Because mm-hmm. It's different when you had to subscribe. It's different when, you know, yeah, it's a very, very different space. And so I don't begrudge anybody, but the nature of the thing is that you don't get these kinds of opportunities and you don't get to see what's really possible when you've got to build. And, you know, inadvertently me coming back on at Titan means I just slammed my foot on the accelerator and I just said, essentially the first 12 have got to be a proving ground that has to be our, you know, mission statement about what this book can be. Because we'll never get this chance again. I'll certainly never get this chance again. And so,
but would you have been this smart about it though if you didn't have the Marvel experience for better or for worse? Right? Like, it's interesting.
No. It's all in the rearview mirror. It makes sense, mm-hmm. but it's ludicrous when I think about it. They never would have come to me to pitch on it. I never would have pitched something. So I never would have found De La Torre. Like, all of it had to go the way it did, of course, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's wild about it is now you look and you go, it seems, I guess obvious isn't the right word. You look and you go, well, look how successful it is. Of course it was going to be, you know, look how beautiful that artwork is. You're like, yeah, but the ingredients, like, why would they have invited me? And then I said, Rob's got to be the artist. Like, Rob was on their radar in a broader sense. Mm-hmm. They thought his artwork was beautiful, but they didn't think they could get him on a monthly book. They didn't think they could get him to launch this thing. They didn't even know him. They'd seen him do some variant covers and stuff, and mm-hmm. they thought it looked really cool, you know? So it's all very, you know, and even Richard, like, Richard sought out Heroic Signatures and sort of gave himself the job, you know? He well, did. He like, basically said, I need to do this. I mean, that's crazy and amazing when you think about it.
Well, I think there's only, what, maybe two letterers in the game who can do that.
Right? And man, thank guys on my book. Like, what a crazy, you know, mm-hmm. confluence. And so, yeah, it's an amazing thing, and it feels very special. And I'm very, very thankful. I'm thankful to publisher and the creative team and the readership and the retailers who that free comic day came out and you know, was like a lightning mm-hmm. strike of excitement in and around the book.
It was a huge launch. Like, it was really well timed, and it seemed like it hit, like, as you said, like a lightning strike.
Yeah.
One thing I want to ask you about in that Conan the Barbarian Free Comic Book Day issue, which, as we said, like, did hit like lightning, there is an absolutely beautiful shot of Conan. It's on the last page when you have this great line of narration leading up to that page, where the idea of that, you know, what lies before Conan. So you have this great, first of all, on page 11, you have this great page that Rob does of all the kind of visions of what's going to happen in the future, you know, the adventures that he's going to have. And then the next page, the last page of this story, you have this narration of yours is, it's time to find out. And the look on Conan's face, there's just something almost gentle about how Rob depicts it, which it just really took me by surprise, but also was just so stunning an image, because we're used to a certain visage of Conan and this being kind of a hard-bitten person at times and going through so much. But there's something about the optimism of that moment, which I found breathtaking. I just thought I'd mention it.
Thanks. it is by design. Honestly, my last issue of Conan at Marvel is number 25, the legacy number 300. Mm-hmm. And if you reread that story, it's, there's, you know, thinly veiled kind of my own fears and frustrations around wrapping up that, the series. Essentially Conan, it's an anniversary issue, so you got to do something kind of crazy. So we end up having Conan fighting, older versions of himself, essentially.
That's right.
And at the very end, you know, Belit says to him, like, how do we know you didn't just destroy the future? And he just says, we can't worry about that. All we can do is, you know, fight on as long as, you know, we get to live our lives. Something to that kind of degree. Essentially, this idea that these stories will continue as long as people want to read them. And, you know, but I don't get to write them anymore, essentially, is the sort of exit out. And now, you know, issue zero was like this hopeful, look, the future lays before us and it's filled with unknowns and excitement and let's go discover it together. And that's sort of like me kind of like, damn, here we are. We're at the beginning again. We're at the beginning of Conan's career in a way that I've never been able to show before. And we have so much potential, this new imprint, this, you know, Conan is arguably the most famous fantasy character in media. Mm-hmm. Like, you could say, yes, people know who characters are from Game of Thrones, and they know characters from The Hobbit, but as a singular hero, you know, Conan predates them all, and he's the Superman of sword and sorcery, you know? Sure. And to be given that kind of opportunity and go, look what lays before us, and let's go get it all. Let's tackle this with as much intensity as humanly possible. That was kind of what I was feeling on it, and trying to give Rob the space, the gravitas to show what makes this character, you know, so special. And of course he delivered on every damn page, and he continues to do so to the delight of me and our readers and the collectors. My God. You know, Rob draws this all traditionally. It's ink on paper, it's brushwork. And those pages are now selling to feverish collectors because it's summoning so much of this character that they know and love. You know what I mean?
Do you have one?
I have three pages. So
which issue?
They're from issues 2 and 3.
Okay.
He literally sold out of everything from issue 0 and 1 before I even had a chance to put in an offer. And I don't begrudge him at all. For him, this has been an absolute. He's been in the industry for a while, but this has been a milestone in his career in a huge, huge way and put him on the map for people. And I just, you know, having one of those original pages, that was sort of what I said to him. I said, I just want one page. And then we started talking back and forth, and eventually I got three. So, really, really special for me to have that and to realize that these things couldn't exist independently of each other, you know. And he's not just following a script. Like, we are collaborating, you know, step by step on this thing to make something really, really special, which is super cool.
A question about the Free Comic Day issues, because obviously that is a different muscle, because instead of the standard, well, I mean, obviously with Titan they're giving you 22, but sure, now you're doing, you know, you have to tell a story in 12 pages. And that is a very specific skill. I mean, I think my favorite writer who does shorter stories is Tom DeFalco. He knocks it out of the park with 10 pages all the time. But what is it like for you to be able to kind of retrain your body, so to speak, to be able to kind of fit what you need to do, but into only 12 pages?
I think it's really important. Free Comic Day is a very unique opportunity, right? Because it's one of the best opportunities to grab people who would never have even looked your way, even remotely. And you will be there staring them down side by side with a lot of other, you know, world beater kind of titles. Everyone knows Spider-Man and the Avengers and Superman and Batman and all this kind of stuff. And you're right there and it's like, why not grab this one? And again, we knew this was a very unique chance for us to go, have you missed Conan? Have you heard how badass this is? Have you heard how cool it was? And we knew we've got to make it, you know, you can't do an M-rated book, but we can make it pretty nasty in the broader sense and make it really, really intense and visceral and make it clear what era we're trying to summon up and push even further, you know? Nice. And so for me, it was like, in those 12 pages, I have to summon the feeling even more than I have to cover plot. And what's crazy is there are no lines of dialogue in the Free Comic Day issue. There is literally no word balloon in the Free Comic Day issue.
You know, I don't think I realized that.
I didn't either. When the pages came in and I summoned up all this narration, I just realized there was no moment where it was necessary. I didn't need a grunt. I didn't need him to scream Crom. I didn't need any of those kinds of things. It was going to feel literary. It was going to feel that third person omnipresent narration that allows us to summon up the feeling of a grand old epic. And once I kind of keyed into that, I just went for it. And it wasn't until we got the first letter proof that I think Heroic Signatures realized there was no dialogue. And they were cool with it. They were like, all right, that's the way we're going. You know, let's then. I think I got one question from Titan. They were like, there's going to be dialogue in the regular issues, right? We're like, yes. Don't worry. It's not going to be. We're not doing Prince Valiant, you know, all the way through here. Whatever.
So I know I have to let you finally get back to your evening at one point. But my last question is going to be, you know, how do you. Obviously, writing Conan is very specific in terms of the vocabulary you use. It has to be, it has to set apart. It can't feel like a modern comic. It has to feel like of that style. So do you have thesauruses with you all the time to try and figure out?
It's so funny you mentioned this. So when I did the first run on Conan, I would like read some Robert E. Howard or I'd read some Roy Thomas issues and I would like get my brain thinking. And then I would jump down and I would do the script and I'd be like, yeah, Conan. Because the relaunch, again, I was like feeling this intense pressure and honor, and like I went through with an absolute fine tooth comb and I reread all the canon Conan stories and the fragments, and I literally, whenever there was a word or a passage that really jumped out to me, I would jot it down in a notebook. And I eventually put together, for lack of a better term, like a vocabulary, like a glossary. Not that I'm trying to, I'm never copying a Robert E. Howard sentence word for word, but the way he will summon a particular type of verbiage, I became much more conscious of it. And so now I have this kind of monster list of poetic little turns of a phrase or language that I will occasionally kind of run through, not because I'm, again, I'm never copying a sentence one for one, but I'm essentially just looking at and going, yeah, this is not just the way he describes Conan's movements, you know, the poetry in terms of the bodies and the smells and the sounds. Like, I need to think in that way and I need to build in that way. And it should never read like any other comic that I'm writing. It shouldn't read like Dungeons and Dragons, and it sure as hell isn't going to read like a superhero book. And so that is very much by design, and I am much, much, much more conscious of it than I ever have been before. And I think that's why it's working. I think, you know, and it is still me. I'm still breaking a story the way I want to break it. I'm still thinking in terms of rhyme and verse in a way that I feel like makes sense to me, but where I can enhance that, you know, add more of that kind of old school gravity to the language. There was a really crazy moment. This is going to sound odd because I'm essentially talking about another podcast.
But, okay, that's allowed.
I recently recorded an episode of the Cromcast, which is this group of guys who started reading the Robert E. Howard stories because the only thing they knew about Conan was the movie and a little bit of the comics. And they were like, we should go back to the source and we'll do a podcast about it. And so they reread all the original, well, they read the original Conan stories and were surprised at some of the differences from, you know, the pop culture interpretations and the assumptions and the stereotypes that have built up over, over the years. And through over the course of years, they've become, you know, kind of experts in their own way and their analysis and stuff like this. And so I've done two episodes with them. And in the second one now, you know, my first arc of Conan has come out. And so we weren't just talking about the potential of what could be. Now it's out there. And they're talking about specific scenes and passages from my comic. And one of the things they'll do when they would read the stories is one of the guys would read with as much gravity as possible. He would read his favorite lines from the stories, and you just, your blood starts pumping. It's such good prose. You know what I mean? And he did that with a couple of my sentences, and I'm listening to someone saying the words I wrote, and they're saying it with such intensity and excitement, the same kind of excitement that they had for, you know, these stories that have made them fans. And that was an absolute honor, you know, and it's mine. I wrote it and I know I wrote it, but hearing it from someone else, you're like, damn, that's not bad. I got to do more of those, you know? And you do feel it when I'm writing this stuff. Every so often I'll come down for lunch or whatever, when I'm working on a lettering script and I've got a weird kind of grin on my face and my wife is like, what's going on? I'm like, I just hit a really good spot. Like, I was in the zone and stuff was flowing and the poetry was kind of coming out, and I think people are going to like it. And, it's a nice feeling.
For sure. Well, again, it has been quite a ride so far. It's been a great surprise is the wrong word, because I knew that you would do a good job, because I enjoyed your Marvel stuff. So I should have known it was going to be even better. But no, it's been a real thrill, and seeing you and Rob working together is, again, been really special. Seeing what Richard's been able to bring to the story, and again, learning so much more about lettering theory from him, and really being totally schooled in a very positive way, has made me think so much differently about how, what choices he makes as well, and more conscious of his choices. But it's been so phenomenal. And then also seeing what Doug brings to it, it's been fascinating to see. And now I have more context to it, hearing how you write it differently. So it makes sense why some things, you know, work differently, not different, you know, no judgment of quality, just different. And it's very interesting.
it's a cool creative process, and it's constantly keeping me challenged, which is so, so valuable, because that's part of the goal. Like, it's not just about, you know, I never want to take any of this for granted. And what's so cool about this right now is not only is it such a unique opportunity to come back to it, but because the process is so visceral and different than before, it's like, man, I'm always thinking. I'm thinking about it, and I'm marinating in it, and then I'm trying to put all as much of that lightning down on the page. And man, it feels really, really cool. And our whole team is just a brilliant crew to be, you know, involved with, whether that's Jose or Dean or Diego or you know, just everybody at every stage of this thing is putting their all into it. And there have been other projects I've worked on where I'm like, oh, it's really special, I think it's going to do well. And sometimes it does pretty good, and sometimes it doesn't do well at all. Mm-hmm. And this one, I was like, man, it feels special, but I've been burned before. And to have the kind of response we have had is just insane. Like, to give you some context, and sales do not equate to quality. I need to stress that over and over and over again, because again, I've got books I'm deeply, deeply proud of, and I think are some of the best things I've ever written, and they will never show up on a Zub reading list. No one gives a damn. But I like them. Mm-hmm. I think they've got something really special going on. But when everything's in alignment, you know, Titan is not a big comic book publisher, and our Conan number one sold more than the Conan relaunch number one at Marvel.
Well, wow. That's incredible.
And we are maintaining sales numbers that are on an indie book that is not the big two, that is not front of the catalog. We are absolutely crushing it. And the readership is doing the impossible, where it is going up from month to month. So obviously your first issue, you have huge numbers, mm-hmm. and then you have a massive drop off, because that's the nature of issue number ones and variants and all that stuff. But from issue 2 to 6, we are climbing back up.
Wow.
Which does not happen in modern comics. And that is because of incredible word of mouth, visceral fan reaction, and so much goodwill from people online. And I could not be more thankful.
No, it's, as I said, it is an incredible book. I know myself, even though I don't need to be doing it, I buy it digitally, and I also buy it in print, because you know, I want to be able to bring it with me, and I also want to be able to share my singles with others so they can also you know, enjoy it. But yeah, no, it's a tremendous book, and I very much enjoy it. So thank you for all the work. As I said before, like, all the passion you guys have for it is immediately evident on the page. Like, it just, it, you can tell that you guys are really loving what you're doing and what you're putting into it.
There is a whole lot of blood, sweat, and more blood going on every issue of Conan the Barbarian.
That's very appropriate. Well, again, Jim, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. It's funny, we talked so much about Conan, I actually completely forgot to ask you about Murder World. So at some point, I will bring you back to do a deep dive into Murder World, because I love that book.
Thank you.
But yeah, no, this has been great doing a deep dive into Conan. It continues to be a really engaging book, and thank you for all the effort you put into it.
Thank you for having me.